Okay, well, this is the time that you can talk with Michelle Belanger about anything, including vampires. Michelle, if somebody thinks that they could be a psychic vampire, what do they do? And then how do you determine that you are one?
Okay, I get asked this all the time. First of all, simply because you think that you're taking energy doesn't necessarily mean you're a psychic vampire. Everybody takes energy from their environment. It comes down to whether or not not taking it has a significant detrimental impact on your health.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend that people first become aware of how they interact with the energy of the people around them. Spend a couple of weeks paying attention to what they do when they talk to people, how they feel when they're in groups of people, how they feel if they've been deprived of interaction and communication with people for a long time. Take into consideration the possibility, I mean, the very very real thing that when people are deprived of interaction with others, they tend to get a little depressed. We're social creatures. Keep notes, keep a journal, track your physical health. Once you are aware of how you interact with energy, take a couple of weeks where you make a point of not taking energy from people, not directly and actively taking it if you're in a conversation or a confrontation or at a concert or something. See if that has a significant, very significant impact on your health. I mean, your average person will probably feel a little bit run down if they do this, but if you start to have very serious health side effects, chances are you are supplementing your health by taking vitality from people around you. And you probably want to be aware of that process so you can do it more efficiently and more ethically.
All right, let's take some calls. Let's go to Buffalo, New York. Hey, Ray, you're up with us. Go ahead, Ray.
Hi, George. Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great.
Hey, listen, me and my fiance, Joe, we're both very impressed with your abilities. What's the difference that you feel between a demon and experiencing an actual, like, person that's passed away?
There is a really different feel to the energy, for lack of a better term, of something that I would identify as demonic. And once you have experienced it, you will never mistake anything else for it again. It is, if I want to give it words, it's dark, it's icky, it's pervasive. It has a sense of almost violence, like an undercurrent of violence to it. There is a sense to it that is very overwhelming.
It's
pretty hard to mistake.
Because she woke up one night, and she was, like, laying on the couch. And she said that there was, like a little two-foot, like, demon kind of looking thing next to her. And it was trying to pull her down through the floor. And she was so terrified. And I know that it had to be real because, you know, she just doesn't make stuff like that up, you know. And it's like, does that sound like something that could really happen?
There are an awful lot of experiences that are reported, historically with people where things manifest that don't necessarily look like living human beings. One of the things from my experiences I've learned is not all the spirits out there are or were human. There's a vast quantity of things, and I don't think there's any way we'd ever be able to catalog them all. And I think that if you look through myth and folklore, you see echoes of these things. You know, you see tales about, you know, little people. You see tales about imps and demons. There's a little grain of truth to all of that stuff. I would say that it's probably not demonic if it doesn't come back and consistently prey upon her. The one thing that I have noticed about the things that we call demons is they usually fixate on a person and they really try to attack them repeatedly and really kind of worm their way into them. Prey upon them. So if it's something that was a one-time experience, it may have been something that looked really scary. And trust me, there are things out there that are definitely negative and that are pretty spooky above and beyond being what I label a demon. I have found all of the people who work with that, who've encountered possession and who will use the label demon, use it very sparingly. There are only a few things that I think really earn that, especially because of the fear that comes the minute you use that word. And you don't want to give it that kind of fear. That fear gives it power.
Indeed. Thanks. So let's go to Jacksonville, Florida. Charmaine, it's your turn. east of the Rockies.
Hey, great man of wisdom, George Norrie. And Michelle, good to speak to you, George. I will say to Michelle, I'll cut to the chase because you're a woman of many plateaus, and I know you don't. I know you like to cut to the chase. I've worked in this area quite a bit, like you, and I live in a place that used to be a 150-year-old plantation, and the earthbound that lives next door to me in this apartment complex, which should be bulldozed, people go in, and they are very nice people, and if you want to talk about psychic vampires in reverse, and we're talking about it in reverse, I know you understand what I'm saying here, this earthbound, I believe, was a slave at one time. He's talked to me, told me his name, Melvin. When it rains, I think he drowned. I'll get to the point here. He will tell me, and I'll tell him, Melvin, it's all right. You're already dead. It doesn't matter. You need to go to the lighter, wherever you need to go. Just go. Leave me alone. He's like a 15-year-old. Leave me alone. But when he gets angry, the whole apartment will shake. And when people go in, they could be a nun, and they will come out, and they have been just drained. They have been also, how would I put it, psychically vampired from the opposite end, and they've been changed. Their personality has been totally changed. And this can happen we've had about 15 people in there in the time I've lived here, about eight years. And I've watched people. I'm an observer. I do stay away from that negative energy. And people on the other end, they're affected, but not as much. But that one apartment is affected. My question to you, Michelle, is since you work on so many plateaus, I've told him to go to the light. He's comfortable with me. But how do you get that away from these people that are going in there unbeknownst to them and are being sucked of energy? People just have died in there. Things have happened. I wouldn't go in there if you paid me $1 million.
Well, first of all, I'm one of those mediums, I guess one of the rare mediums. I don't believe that we can just open a door and kick a spirit through into the light. I think it's very presumptuous to assume that we have the right or even the ability to force something to move on. That being said, a lot of spirits can be helped to move on. Basically, they need a good therapist. There are things that they can't let go of from the most recent life. And I think that you have a special relationship with the spirit, so you should engage him in conversation. I know telling him to move on is something that you've done, but see about trying to rehabilitate him. Treat him like a person who has problems, and treat him in the same way that you would a neighbor who is going through a really rough time, and try to get him to realize why he's still here, and try to get him to realize what to let go of. Now, for the people who are going into that space, and it's a very important point you bring up, one of the reasons that I work with spirits, especially with defense, with people teaching people how to defend themselves against spirits, is the main method a spirit has to prey on people and attack them is the exact same thing that an unintentional vampire or an unethical vampire does. Psychic vampires take energy, so do spirits. It's the best and most debilitating attack that they have, far more common than, throwing things around or leaving scratches on people.
What do you think is the spirit world, Michelle? Where is it?
It's here. It's within and throughout everything. It's really, we call it the other side because we don't have a better way of calling it, but it's here. The spirit world is a part and an integral part of the world that we live in. And we forget that we are both body and spirit, so we already kind of have one leg up on the spirit. We have two states of being in all of that space. They're everywhere.
And I would suspect the spirit world might have come first.
I think so.
Let's go to Miami, Florida. Jamal, it's your turn. Hi.
Hey, how's it going, George?
Good, Jamal.
All right.
Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I know I'm on the wild card line, but I'm also a first-time caller. I love the show. It's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Michelle, I have a question for you. I've pretty much kind of been learning how to discern things for a while now, but, your messages and everything you say comes out really, really humble. And I guess my question for you pretty much is this. What would be your single most important piece of advice for someone who is starting to get a grasp on pretty much manifesting changes in your reality? Simple as that.
Believe that you can. And sometimes reality will push back. You can say that that's the universe or the God or whatever, that there is an order to things. And we can push and we can get quite a lot. But sometimes we don't realize that our intentions are selfish. And if you feel just a subtle push of, you know, maybe you don't want to go in this direction, reality does guide you when you have that ability. I attribute most of my success and where I am right now to learning how to manifest, but also learning how to listen when it says, no, you don't want that.
Is that why evil, for example, begets evil? If you are in an evil state, it sometimes comes back to you five times if one is doing that?
I believe that there is a pattern and an order to the universe, and if you push too hard, it will push back.
Afton, Virginia, you're on Coast to Coast now. Nan, take it away.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to know what I'm doing. When you announced Michelle, I didn't recognize her name, but I started to feel really ill right before you announced her name. And then when you said what she did, I started to feel really ill. And I feel the same way if I'm around like a cell phone or most electronic devices, and I mess up electronic devices. I break the filaments on light bulbs if I'm upset and I'm near them. And if I'm in... I was born with a certain amount of my own ability, but if I'm in a room with people who have ability, I pick up abilities I didn't have before I walked into that room. And I have to be careful how much time I spend with people, because if I start taking on the energy from people, I start having their dreams and not feeling well and having thoughts that aren't mine and feelings that aren't mine. But by the same token, if I'm away from natural things for very long, I get sick. I mean, I get physically ill, I get colds, I get flus. I can't really spend a lot of time in cities. So what am I doing?
Some of that sounds like what I call an empath, somebody who doesn't so much take in the emotions of others, but who is such a finely tuned wire energetically and psychically that everything around them vibrates them, like to the core of their being. It sounds like that you are so hypersensitive that anything you're exposed to starts to manifest as almost a physical reaction. There was somebody that we were working with PRS, who she thought that she was being attacked by things in her house. What turned out to be the case was her psychic ability manifested as physical ailments. Like she would be exposed to a spirit and she'd feel it, like her heart was racing and she would get nauseous and she'd be in pain. And our abilities manifest in many different ways. They speak to us in different language. A lot of mediums and psychics will use very visual language to describe what they're perceiving, but that's almost misleading because some people, it manifests as different sensations. I think that at least part of what you're doing is you're picking up on energy, and as such a finely tuned wire, you are reacting with a very physical reaction to it. As someone who has a hard time being connected to nature stuff, the natural world is the best and first supplier of energy for people. In a perfect world and with a perfectly healthy energy body, you should be sustained by the natural world around you. And I think everybody gets sick in the city. They just don't realize it. They're not as sensitive to you. They're not as tuned in.
Michelle, overall, what have you learned about this realm, this psychic realm that you deal with, that you've learned about? If you had to categorize the whole thing, what would you say about it?
Wow, it is far bigger than I could possibly ever catalog or understand in one single lifetime. And if you gave me 1,000 lifetimes consecutively where I could remember everything from lifetime to lifetime, I would still be cataloging what is on that side.
All right, next up, let's go to Cesar in San Francisco. Cesar, how are you?
Hi, George. Hi, Michelle. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a couple of questions. Actually, I just have one because I know you're stretched for time. Michelle, I'm concerned about Ryan on the show. The man puts himself in the line of fire when he does these shows. He even has like a personal war with this one demon whose name he will not utter out loud. And my question is, can this take a toll on his mind and body over time? And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess he's talking about paranormal state, right?
Yeah, paranormal state. Ryan himself has acknowledged that it is exhausting to do the sort of work that he does, to be in the battle that he is engaged in. And, heck, taking a toll, just the filming takes a toll on a person. I know the last season got pretty crazy just for nonstop travel. So above and beyond the psychic work that he's doing, the battle that he's engaged with dark forces that inevitably, you know, whittle away at you, he feels, in one of the cases, candidly, he had mentioned that he felt there are religious people who are much better cut out to do the sort of work because they have more spiritual armor, so to speak. They are purer of heart than he feels that he himself is. And I know that he is concerned with temptation or falling off his path or being overcome by this, but he also takes faith in the fact that he has many friends who support him. And I think if he runs out of the ability to deal with it, he has many people who will support him. So if you ever worry too hard, send some energy his way. It will certainly help.
It works, doesn't it?
It does.
Let's go to Janesville, Wisconsin. Travis, we can squeeze you in before the break. Go ahead, Travis.
Great. Thank you, George.
Sure.
Michelle, I have a couple of real quick questions for you. I've had a lot of experiences with spirits, some negative, but most of them have been very, very positive experiences where they've made themselves known and they've been very accommodating, made me feel very welcome. And in fact, I believe I actually have a spirit of a cat that has been following me around for the last several years of my life. Now, what about spirits of animals and friendly, helpful spirits?
Not all spirits are bad. A lot of people react to spirits negatively simply because they don't know the rules by which they behave. It has been my experience that more spirits are harmless than are harmful. And I actually have a couple of spirits that I consider very good friends that kind of hang around and will watch after me and help to protect me on that side from things that maybe I don't perceive, threats that I don't perceive myself. So I firmly believe that many spirits, they're not all earthbound in the sense that they are lingering against their will or that they're wrapped up in some sort of problem. Some of them choose to stay. Some of them are helpful. And, yeah, I have had so many people report spirits of cats. Heather Hoffman, one of the mediums that I work with, when I visited her a couple of months ago, there was a black cat that was trying to get into her apartment, and we sort of joked that he was trying to move in. And he was a stray, and she already had two cats. She didn't want the cat. And things happened such that the cat ended up having to be put to sleep. He was hit by a car in the lot. And several people visiting her apartment have noticed a cat that fits the description of this cat. And he seems to have decided to move in spirit. I believe that animals have spirits.
I think some of the greatest stories about the animals, Michelle, for example, when someone's in bed and they see the little invisible but paw prints, indentations on the sheets and mattress.
Yeah,
here they come.
Cat-shaped spot on the bed or the dog.
Stay with us. When we come back, we'll take final phone calls with Michelle. Fascinating night right here on Coast to Coast AM. Take them to Get with Lex and they get a free StreamLink weekend coming up in the not-too-distant future. Those of you who would like to join and become StreamLink members, you can get podcasts and downloads that way. It's pretty fascinating. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Michelle Bélanger. That's French, isn't it?
It is. It means beautiful angel.
How about that? How does your family feel about you being a psychic vampire?
I come from a family on both sides that are psychic, and so at least the sensitivity to energy and the perceiving of spirits wasn't really too weird of an idea. My mom was a little concerned that the psychic vampirism was, like, too dark, that I was, like, into things that were too dark until I explained it to her, and she learned to understand, like, exactly what it was, that I wasn't, you know, running around cutting myself or stalking up and down the streets in a cape. And actually, with her experience with cancer, I helped to teach her how to work with her own energy to manage the pain and the nausea. And so she became a lot more positive about it when she found that there were positive applications, that it wasn't just this horrible thing that I had to live with.
Were you gothic when you were younger?
I was a little bit of a goth. I still wear all black at this point just because it makes the laundry easier.
All right.
Gothic in the sense of I love the romantic poets and, you know, wrote a lot of dreary poetry in high school. I think when you're a teenager, you're sure the world is a terrible, horrible place and it's all out to get you. So, you know, you write mopey poetry. Eventually you grow up.
At least in the States, Michelle, how big is the vampire community?
In the thousands and probably tens of thousands. There is a group called the Atlanta Vampire Alliance, and a couple of their members spearheaded an unprecedented survey that you will be seeing in a book by Joseph Laycock called, called Vampires Today. It's coming out this year. It's a scholarly work. He's at Harvard Divinity, and it's a study of the vampire community. And there are tens of thousands of people who identify as vampires. Both psychic vampires as well as blood drinkers, as well as hybrids, which are not Priuses or cars, but people who do a little bit of both. I don't really like the word hybrid. Again, it makes me think about cars.
I know some get permanent fangs put on as caps, don't they?
Well, in New York City, there is a unique subsection of the vampire subculture. And in New York City, although there are people who are legitimately vampiric, there's also a strong social and fashion aspect to it. There's a lot of people that we call lifestylers. And, yeah, they're the ones who dress, kind of adopt the vampire as a personal image. And this seems really weird to a lot of people, but if you think about, like, country music or hip-hop, there's almost a fashion and an ideal and a philosophy that goes for people who are really into those, you know, the cowboy and the gangsta. And both of those are kind of like outlaws and these rebel figures for people who are lifestylers who adopt the vampire. In many ways, it's the same thing. It's this icon that affects their fashion, affects their philosophy, and is kind of, it plays a central part in their music and their art. So it's more an artistic movement in many ways.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Final callers, North Carolina, Tim on the wild card line. Tim, welcome. You're on with Michelle.
Okay. Michelle, I have a question about something that has always mystified me. In 1992, I was a patient at Dorothea Dix State Mental Hospital in Raleigh.
Okay.
And then there was another patient. He was a young man. He was so deeply disturbed he could not even speak. But on two different occasions, this fella ignored everybody else that was around and turned toward me full front and made growling and animal sounds looking straight at me. It was so intense. I never saw him do it to anybody else. I have always wondered, what in the world was that all about?
Something about you caught his attention, and this might be metaphysical, and it might be purely physical. There may be something. Some autistic children cannot pay attention to anybody in their environment, won't make eye contact, but one person seems to be somebody they take a shine to or that they can connect with. Either he saw something that he could connect with in you, or there was something in you that he found threatening. Something connected. Somehow there was a connection between you and him that allowed him to focus on you rather than anybody else. Again, it could be metaphysical, it could be energetic, or it could have been a purely psychological cue, something in your body language, something that he saw. And again, you're talking about someone whose psychology is radically different from ours. So there's no way to predict what it was that made him single you out. But for him, I can guarantee it was significant.
He sure was.
did his actions scare you, Tim?
Well, George, not a whole lot. The fellow didn't come toward me. He didn't even move. He just stood there and glowered at me and made animal sounds, looking straight at me.
Might have been the only language he could manage.
Well, I don't think this man could speak. He was really, really ill.
He was out of it. Gone. Yeah.
You scared me, George.
That's a great story. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
That is, some of those guttural sounds are scary, Michelle, aren't they?
Oh, they are. My great aunt worked in Cleveland Psychiatric, and I volunteered there a couple of times. And yeah, especially certain types of mental illness are, first of all, almost indistinguishable from what people would label demonic possession. And wow, people do some pretty strange things.
Have you ever taken a bite out of somebody's neck?
Nope.
All right.
No, not really quite my thing.
Truth or dare? Juneau, Alaska, we go. Hey, Mitchell, you're on with us.
Hey, Michelle and George, how you doing?
Good, Mitch.
Doing pretty good.
That's good to hear. Talking about psych, I worked in psych when I'm 52 now, but I worked in psych when I was 18 in Warminster General Hospital in Pennsylvania. That was quite a while ago. I got a question for you.
Sure.
I don't want to say his name because he's a famous musician, but I have strange reoccurrences that happen to me, and you could call it a breakdown, or you could call it, the supernatural, or, just use your imagination, decide for yourself. But I was told from my inner self that some people have horrible, really horrible lives as vampires because, one guy, supposedly he's famous, famous rock star or whatever, and he got bitten on a pirate ship back in the 1600s. And, he plays his role and does what he does, but, is that how far these people,
You're saying that this current rock star Mitchell is 400 years old?
Yeah.
Huh.
But he has to do the ritual.
I've never personally met the immortal, blood sucking, classic sort of like Lestat or Dracula vampire. I acknowledge that the world is full of possibilities. So simply because I've never met one doesn't mean that they don't exist. But I will say that every person I've met who has claimed to be that type of vampire is usually sort of some guy who lives in his mom's basement and plays World of Warcraft too much.
You never know. Okay, Mitchell,
but
thanks for the story.
You never know. You never know.
Stephanie in Miami. Go ahead, Stephanie.
No, it's a privilege to talk to you both. Hello.
Hi.
Michelle. I have a question. The Bible says the soul is in the blood.
Yes,
so that's scripture. Okay. Do you feel that when a vampire does drink blood, that they acquire an essence of the soul itself?
The word that they use is the life. Ruach is the same. Actually, it's a cognate of like prana in Hinduism, breath, life, energy. So it's this vitality that in the Bible God breathed into all beings, the breath of life. I do not believe that somebody who's taking that is taking the soul, but I will say that in the book of Leviticus and in the other biblical passages, the reason that the people of Israel are told to keep kosher and let the blood spill out and not eat the blood is in that belief system, that vital spark belongs to God, that is divine, and so man should not take it into themselves. I know a Jewish blood drinker, and she tries to be a very good Jew, except for the fact that she drinks blood, which is absolutely not kosher.
Oh.
But there are other blood drinkers who firmly believe that it is a material, physical component of the blood, that's something medical science would be able to, with proper study, understand. So they don't take a metaphysical perspective at all. Some of the ones that I relate to better, I can understand blood drinkers who think that they're using the blood as a focus for the energy, for that spark of life.
Yeah.
I can understand that because I cut to the chase and don't bother with the blood. I know how to take that spark into myself, and I think that it is something that we can all share in as long as we do so responsibly.
Right.
But strictly speaking from the Bible, the blood is the life, and the life belongs to God, and man, being a finite earthly creature, does not have a right to it.
Okay, Los Angeles we go with an anonymous caller. Hi there.
Hi there. Michelle, thanks for and thanks for taking my call. I've got a really simple question, but it's a moral question, I guess. It's really this. It's relating to the depiction of malicious spirits in movies.
Mm-hmm.
some movies being meant as just pure sensationalism, a horror movie or something like that. It's just meant to be a part of that genre. But you can also make movies that are literally examining a subject with the intention of accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
So my question really is this, and it's something I've thought of for a while, and I've always wondered about it. If a film accurately depicts malicious spirits and their effects on people, or just simply perpetuates this raw, primal fear that you can't even really put into words, and it just really scares the living daylights out of you, with this very realistic, accurate symbolism or whatever, does this give real entities power? And do you feel this ultimately harms people? And with that, I'll stay on or go off, whatever you guys would like.
It could give those entities power, especially if it is promoting fear and accurate fear of a thing. I would say that it would have the greatest benefit for the spirit if someone were to accurately portray a specific spirit with its specific name. Let's say the demon, Elagos in the Goetia, and somebody decides to portray Elagos in all of his nasty glory and does so distinctly, accurately, and with the intent to get millions of people in the audience to fixate on that particular entity with fear. Yes, that would give it power.
When you were writing the book Vampires in Their Own Words, did you have to live in the communities for a while?
I have been, well, not directly with the folks in New York. I mean, I'm friends with many of these people. Being part of the psychic vampire community, we kind of mix and mingle. And being out in Ohio, it's a very different sort of community than, say, like New York. But yeah, I've met with people on their own turf. I've been at some really underground clubs in New York where they do really extraordinary things like hang people from hooks and put large needles in people's veins and drink directly out of that. I mean,
I
said the New York scene was one of the most extreme and
that's
a really
extreme.
Unusual subset, I really wasn't kidding. And I kind of go into all of the places that I go with this, I guess, neutral, non-judging, you know, this is their culture, this is not necessarily my culture, and as long as nothing's directly harming me and people are consensual in what they're doing, I'm not going to object to it, and just experience what they're experiencing, observe it, understand why they do what they do. And in Vampires in Their Own Words, the intent was to let people tell their own stories. Now, you don't have anyone in that particular book who is as extreme as the few people that I've run into, one or two groups, but there is a movie I was involved in that you can see some of that depicted. Obviously, it's highly censored in a lot of ways. Like, honestly, the footage that I saw from that one particular place, the really extreme footage that ended up on Laurent Coco's Vampires When Reality Surpasses Fiction, it turned my stomach. And I'm pretty inured to some of the crazier stuff that I've seen people do.
First-time caller in Rohnert Park, California. Devin, take it away.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Sure thing, Devin.
All right. Well, I have a question for Michelle.
Okay.
Fire away.
All right. Well, I've had psychic abilities since I was a little boy, and I got scared really bad one time. My friend died in a car crash, and one night I woke up to my alarm clock going off in the middle of the night for no reason, and I got up and turned it off, and leaning against my nightstand was my dead friend. And he said, "What's up?" right to my face, like he was standing right there. And at that moment, I decided to deny it, closed my eyes, went back to bed, and thought, I must be dreaming. I must, you know, be half asleep. And but since then, I've gotten more interest into basically enhancing my abilities. Do you have any advice for me?
It's not uncommon when you have a frightening experience for people to shut the door. And I will say it has been my experience that when you have natural abilities and you have shut the door, especially out of fear, it is often harder and more challenging to open it back up. But my advice would be, first of all, to make peace with it, to not be afraid. Yes, these abilities can show you very frightening things. And some of the most frightening are the things that are real. Death-announcing dreams are probably some of the most shaking, where you have a dream or you have a vision and then that person passes away, because sometimes you start to feel that maybe you didn't foresee it, but you somehow caused it. Make peace with the ability, and then approach everything objectively to try to open yourself. Honestly, most of us experience these things and are aware of them all of the time. We've all had the experience where we walk into a room where two people have been arguing, and they're not arguing anymore, and they're not even in the room, but you can still feel the tension on the air. There's none of your five physical senses that are telling you that that tension is there, but we still feel it and react to it. Listening. Learning to listen, because these abilities are not Hollywood special effects. They're not so obvious that you couldn't deny them. So paying attention to how you react to a place, to a person, and listening to those subtle cues, and learning to trust that intuition when it manifests. And the more you pay attention to it, the better a handle you'll get on it. We're all psychic to one degree or another, and really this is part of our human experience.
Okay, so Michelle, on Halloween, what do you dress up as?
Last year, I dressed up as Wolverine. I am a total geek, by the way. although, frankly, if I'm working on Halloween, and I frequently am, I do lectures around at colleges. Nobody really wants me to dress up as anything but me. I used to love Halloween. I love making costumes and things like that and really get into it. But, yeah, these days I don't get much of a chance to go to Halloween parties. I'm usually flying halfway across the country to go talk to people about vampires.
Well, you're one of the few psychic vampires that seems also to give off energy instead of just take it all the time.
If you know what you're doing, all it is just knowing how to connect to the energy. And really, any performer should know how to do this, where you connect to the crowd and you take energy in, but you give it back. Dolly Parton even said recently in an extensive interview that she's an energy vampire, but she's always given back when she takes.
Yeah, amazing. Thanks, Michelle, for being on the program. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.